Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Policy Experts Discuss Recent Trip to the Border call. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for questions and comments following the presentation. If you should require assistance throughout the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad to reach a live operator. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Megan McKenna. Ma'am, the floor is yours.
Guys, thank you very much, Dagma, and thank you everyone for joining us today for this call. I am Megan McKenna, Kids Senior Director of Communications for Kids in Need of Defense. And today we're going to hear from four immigration experts who recently visited the U.S. border, Tijuana, to see the conditions on the border and of the makeshift refugee camps, and to determine the protection gaps for the most vulnerable there, particularly unaccompanied children and families. And what they found is profoundly disturbing and a great cause of alarm for the safety of unaccompanied children and other vulnerable populations that needs to be addressed immediately. Children are in grave danger as we speak, and they are right in our backyard, literally steps away from our border. I will now introduce our speakers who will describe what they saw, including firsthand stories of unaccompanied children and families. One note to say, in addition to our experts, we have Jennifer Podkel, who is Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy at KIND, Lisa Friedman, who is the Vice President of Regional Policy and Initiatives at KIND, Maria Odom, Vice President for Legal Services at KIND, and Michelle Bernay, the Director of the Migrants and Rights Justice Program at the Women's Refugee Commission. Also, Dr. Alan Shapiro of the American Academy of Pediatrics was also visited the border recently, but unfortunately he cannot be on the call today. But if anyone is interested in talking to him about what he saw, you can call the following number, and that is 202-724-3301, or you can contact one of us and we can provide information. Okay, I will now open the floor to Jennifer Podkel.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks, everybody, for joining. Now, there has been really great reporting on the general situation for asylum seekers and how the U.S. government, specifically Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection, has been metering and limiting asylum seekers and their access to protection in the United States. However, we went to look at the specific population of unaccompanied children because there are distinct laws and procedures in Mexico and in the United States that dictate how this population is to be treated, as well as specific rights and protections that they're entitled to. Now, both of these countries are very well resourced, and dealing with migrants from Central America is not a new issue for either of them. Mexico has very progressive child protection laws, and the United States has been a leader on improving child protection in refugee situations around the world. But despite this, what we saw was children who have been completely failed by both countries, who are falling through the cracks. They're being forced underground and placed in extreme danger by the same laws that were designed to protect them. Many children we interviewed in the camps and in shelters are seeking to comply with the Trump administration's goal of having all asylum seekers present themselves at the ports of entry. However, they're being blocked by both Mexican officials as well as U.S. officials from doing so. So as a result, after languishing in squalid conditions, some are contemplating trying to enter the United States between the ports of entry and just flag down a Border Patrol agent to ask for protection because they can't withstand the wait any longer. They realize the danger of doing this, but for many of them, it really seems like it's the only option now. Unlike adults and families who are being forced to put their names on a list and wait for their turn to ask for protection at the port of entry, unaccompanied children are being told that they're not eligible to even get on this list. In Mexico, UACs are to be cared for by the government child welfare agency. However, once they're in the Mexican government care, children are only given two options from detention: either ask for asylum in Mexico or be repatriated to their country of origin. This is resulting in children trying to dodge child welfare workers whose job it is to protect them. And my colleague Lisa Friedman will discuss this in more detail. So as you can imagine, dodging child protection workers means children are languishing in extremely dangerous and unhealthy camps, attaching themselves to unscrupulous adults, or deciding to accept return to their home country, but with every intention of trying again, exposing them to the dangerous and arduous journey yet again. And some children we met with were able to get past the Mexican officials to present themselves at the U.S. port of entry. However, several of these children, as you will hear about, were turned away by U.S. officials in violation of the law. So to give you more detail about this, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Lisa.
Thanks, Jen. I maybe want to start with an example which I think helps explain some of what's going on. And in particular, I actually want to talk about the case of 14-year-old and 16-year-old Mexican siblings who we met with at a shelter for unaccompanied children. And these siblings have their parents living in the United States. And when I met with them, they said that they had to flee their town in Mexico because their lives were in danger and they were under threat and it was no longer safe for them. Their goal was to enter the United States and seek asylum and to reunify with their parents. And they made it to the port in San Ysidro. They got to Tijuana, made it to the San Ysidro port, and presented themselves to CBP officials. They very clearly expressed that they're afraid to return to their community in Mexico and that they wanted to seek asylum in Mexico, in the United States. And they were told to sit down and shut up, and they were transferred to a holding cell, and then Mexican consulate was contacted, and they were back in Mexico the next day. They were never transferred into Office of Refugee Resettlement custody, despite, you know, very clearly U.S. laws requiring that in the case of a Mexican child who is afraid to go back to Mexico, that they should be transferred to Office of Refugee Resettlement custody. So they were immediately sent back to Mexico, felt incredibly vulnerable, and they were able to find a nonprofit organization to assist them in trying to come back to the United States a second time. So they went back to the port, and when they tried to reach the port this time, they were blocked by Mexican officials before they even were able to access the port. They were asked if they're of their ages and if they were with their parent, and when the answer was that they're minors and that they weren't with their parent, they were told that they could not get to the U.S. port, they could not enter the port as unaccompanied children. They were told that there's a list for asylum seekers, and they asked to join the list, but then they were told that unaccompanied children can't be on the list. And they were told that the Mexican officials, the child welfare officials, were going to be contacted because they were unaccompanied and they were going to go into custody. And they were told all of this by Mexican immigration officials who also said to them, quote unquote, U.S. law has changed and this is why this is happening. Those children now are back in Mexico and they are terrified of being sent back to their community, and all they want to do is be able to reach the United States, seek protection, following the law in accordance with the laws that we have, and reunify with their parents. And they are being blocked from doing that, even though they are they're in Tijuana, incredibly close to the United States, incredibly close to protection and their parents. We also met with four Honduran children. I also met with four Honduran children who, as Jen described, were given only the options of being repatriated to their country of origin or seeking asylum in Mexico. All of them had a close family member, and several of them had a parent in the United States. But they were no one discussed with them the option of potentially seeking protection in the United States. And as Jen said, with those options being presented to them, these children are putting themselves at great risk because they're being prevented from reaching the United States. And so, for example, one of the children said to me, I'm going to go back to Honduras and I'm going to come back with a smuggler because I'm trying to reach my mom and I'm trying to seek protection in the United States. And so the fact that this child is in Tijuana and has not been harmed during his journey and is this close to reaching his mom and the protection process in the United States, and now instead has to choose to go back to Honduras and turn around and place himself in grave danger, is very, very concerning. And I think that those stories really set out some of what we saw. My colleague Maria will add to that further. The only other thing that I would say is that to add to what Jennifer said, the Mexican protection system for unaccompanied children is supposed to look at what is in the best interests of these children, of unaccompanied children, before repatriating them to their country of origin. As part of a consideration of what's in their best interest, there's not even the fact that having a parent in the United States may well indicate that it's in the child's best interest to come to the United States and reunify with that parent is not being considered in these cases. And in the majority of cases, best interest determinations do not seem to be happening before these children are repatriated to their country of origin. And so, as my colleague Jennifer mentioned, these children are faced with basically, if you get detected by child welfare officials, who are the very officials who are supposed to protect you and offer you support and services, you're basically going to be deported to your country. That's their understanding. And therefore, they have no choice but to be in the most vulnerable situation and not avail themselves of those services because it means essentially deportation to their country. I'll turn it over to my colleague Maria now. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. I would like to specifically discuss three cases in which I personally met with unaccompanied children, all from Honduras. Those three children attempted entry with a group of UACs, of unaccompanied children, as well as advocates who sought to ask for protection at the U.S. port of entry. All three children independently described the scene at the port of entry in the following manner. All stated that they indicated to CBP that they were seeking protection. They were asked where they were from, and they were asked for their ages. All of them disclosed they were under 18 and from Honduras, at which point they all stated that CBP asked them to step aside if they were from one of those countries. We understand that to be one of those countries in the Northern Triangle. At that point, all of them were turned over to Mexican authorities. One of them attempted reentry unlawfully between the ports of entry because he was desperate to seek protection. The border, he alleges that after crossing two barriers, he was apprehended by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, by the Border Patrol. The three adults who were with him, unrelated to him, were apprehended and taken into CBP custody. He was made to jump the barriers back into Mexico. He then fell into the custody of the Mexican authorities, where he remained for 2 weeks, and where he alleges he suffered beatings and mistreatment by a Mexican guard. The other two children also presented with significant protection claims, all of them fleeing violence, some of them with very specific instances of threats and concerns for their safety in home country, all of them indicating their fear of return, and also indicating their intent to remain near the border to seek protection. I also want to share with you about a child we met right outside the first shelter that is now closed at Benito Juarez. We encountered several unaccompanied minors there among the population that has refused to be transported to El Barretal, the new shelter, out of fear that they don't have the resources to get back to the border, as well as just uncertainty over what to find at El Barretal, lack of information and lack of infrastructure. At Benito, the conditions are extremely dangerous. Where there are no services, there is no coordinated relief effort. I personally spoke with one 15-year-old who was very fearful for his life in that setting, was very confused, was looking for information, but also had a lot of trepidation about being transported to a barretal. There are no support services at Benito. Those children are in a very vulnerable position, not only facing, I think, deteriorating health, which we saw among all the children. Some of them had a fever. Many of them were sick, and Dr. Shapiro will be best positioned to discuss that with you. I certainly encourage you to reach out to him. From the perspective of the declining health of these children, both who are living on the street, those who are at El Barrital, at, you know, in Benito Juarez, as well as those who are in shelter care. This particular child refused to be transported to a shelter out of concern for his fellow 15-year-old, whose whereabouts remained unknown. So not only are they burdened with caring for themselves in the most austere and horrible conditions, but they're also now caring for one another without support from the authorities. We also witnessed at Benito conditions impacting accompanied children, very small toddlers without access to food, drinking water, clean drinking water, and other services that they are obtaining at El Barrital. And we also saw a lack of transportation for these individuals between Benito and El Barrital. It's unclear how they're working to make that option available to them. So generally, from the children with whom I met, I walked away with the sense that they do have, as we suspected anew, significant protection needs. They have little information on how to approach the port of entry. They are terrified of falling into the custody of Mexican authorities, and they are confused about, you know, what's in store for them. I will stop there and turn it back to, I'll turn it to Michelle Brené, who will also share some of her insights.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you, everybody, for joining the call. So we were also, at the Women's Commission, sent down a team. I was there a few weeks ago, and then we have a team on the ground now. You know, I think you've heard about a lot of the problems around unaccompanied children. I'll just add a little bit to that mix. I mean, the situation, as Maria described, on the ground in terms of humanitarian concerns is very, very dire and quite concerning. The situation is unsafe. It's unhealthy and completely inappropriate for large numbers of people, but especially for unaccompanied children who really have nowhere to turn and no safe spaces, and women and families with young children who are also a large part of this group who have no place to turn really in this situation. And what I want to make really clear that I think has already been explained by KIND is that the situation has been created by the U.S. government's refusal to allow people to request asylum at the ports of entry as they're required to do by law. They've been turning people away and really forcing them into these conditions. And at the same time, Mexican officials are refusing to accept any responsibility as described, especially for the unaccompanied children, in terms of acknowledging their right to seek asylum in the United States and adequately assessing their protection needs. You know, there's this system for getting on a list. I sort of say that in quotation marks because there is no official list. The U.S. government sends people to go stand in line or get themselves on a list, but then takes no responsibility for who is managing that list, how that list is managed, who gets on it, and what happens. And so there's an enormous amount of potential for exploitation in that process, and we observed quite a bit of that in terms of, you know, who gets on the list and how. And we've heard already that for unaccompanied children in particular, it's really they have no answer. And so what we've been seeing and what you've probably been hearing about is attorneys who have been accompanying children to sort of demand their right at the border, which is also very problematic in the sense that that is not a systemic solution. Not everybody has access to attorneys, and there's also difficulty in getting that access for children. You know, I think you heard some of the stories, and just to tell another story about this situation of kids being turned back and put into really dangerous situations, that is exactly one of the things that the TVPRA, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, was intended to address. Children being turned back at the border and sent back into situations where they are extremely vulnerable to smugglers, traffickers, and general dangers from organized crime, from you know, corruption, all sorts of situations, as you've heard. And while we were there, one of the we talked to a lot of kids and had very similar stories to what Maria and Lisa already recounted. But we spoke to one 16-year-old boy who was there with his 8-year-old brother. He was very fearful to even tell us that he was unaccompanied initially because he was worried about being sent to into the Mexican system where he would be deported. He and his brother were trying to get to their parents who were in the United States. And we finally, you know, managed to convince him that he should go to the children's shelter where he would be safer and might have an opportunity to speak to attorneys. But when he went back to get his 8-year-old brother, to get him to come to go to the shelter with us, he came back and said that he couldn't find his brother because he had apparently already left with a group of smugglers who were going to try to enter another way. And these are exactly the kinds of situations that we worry about, kids who are trapped with no solutions and are therefore really vulnerable to even more dangerous options, potentially. I also just want to mention that it's not only children or people who came in the official sort of caravan that are at risk here. This policy of limiting who they process each day affects everybody seeking asylum at the U.S. border, including Mexicans. We spoke to a Mexican woman and her 16-year-old daughter who were fleeing cartels. The girl's father had already been killed while they were waiting to get into the United States, and they had been waiting for over a month on this supposed list to get in. And again, were subject to the very government that already had shown that they couldn't protect them. So, you know, there's Venezuelans, there's others who are in this situation waiting to get in and being refused access to asylum or any other option for seeking protection. So what should be happening? You know, first of all, the government, the U.S. government, should not be turning away asylum seekers. We have signed on to the Refugee Convention, and we have U.S. laws. The U.S. immigration laws require that people be processed for asylum when they present at the border. And we have the ability and the resources to do that, just not the will in the current moment. At the same time, if the U.S. is going to refer people to some list or try to control or regulate the access, they have to have some order to the process and not leave it to the chaotic situation that it is now. And Mexico and the U.S. really have to come to some agreement as to how children in particular are going to be processed and given appropriate information about their rights and what the best situation for them is. Again, I think the U.S. and Mexico here, the U.S. by turning people away and Mexico in their complicity in preventing access to the border are really endangering people's lives, and that's what this comes down to. I'll leave it for questions now, I guess. Back to the moderator, maybe?
Yeah, thank you very much, Michelle. Yes, without further ado, let us open the floor to questions, please.
Operator, can you give instructions to open it up, the floor up to questions?
While we wait for questions, may I share?
Yeah.
I think following up to Michelle's excellent recap, I want to reiterate that we interviewed informally one Mexican private security official sitting at the bottom of the pedestrian bridge to access the U.S. port of entry, as well as an official from the Mexico Immigration Authority, both of whom confirmed that they were under directions not to allow unaccompanied children onto the bridge. They referred us to the table where migrants are managing the asylum list. They seemed to not recognize that children were not being allowed to get on those lists. More importantly, they didn't seem to recognize the rights of the children to approach the U.S. Port of Entry to seek protection. So we do have documented through firsthand interviews that this is, in fact, the direction that they have received. And finally, to Michelle's point about the particular vulnerability of families traveling with small children, And given the recent incident of a death in Border Patrol custody, I want to highlight one particular case outside of the Benito Juarez former shelter site of a very small toddler who had just experienced a severe seizure prior to our arrival on site, with multiple individuals confirming that the child turned purple, the child turned stiff, and had recovered by the time we had arrived. They called the ambulance and no medical help had arrived. So these children, eventually, if they do reach a port of entry, will be arriving in much deteriorated health conditions. And that drives, I think, the point with urgency that the humanitarian response needs to be more robust and more comprehensive.
Operator, are you there? Yes, I'm here. Hi, can you...
Operator, can you open the floor to questions, please?
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Questions will be taken in the order they were received. If at any time your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing 1. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Please hold while we poll for questions.
Operator, are there questions?
It doesn't look like we have any incoming questions. Oh, hold on, one just came in from Sonia Nazario with New York Times. Please state your question.
Hi, I have 3. So is your contention that, for example, of 10 children, are all of them being barred from accessing ports of entry as unaccompanied minors? Second, is there any indication that the number of kids, irregardless of being unaccompanied and unaccompanied minors being deported by Mexico has gone up in recent months? And finally, is metering legal?
I'll take the first question. This is Lisa. On the first question, what we very clearly observed was both the difficulties on the Mexico side of even getting to the U.S., right, to the port, to meet with CBP. And so we saw both, and it was actually several Mexican officials, INM officials, that I interviewed informally. It was 4 in total, every single one of whom, and some were Grupo Beta. Actually, it was 4 INM non-Grupo Beta, and then an additional, I spoke to someone from Grupo Beta, so 5 officials. Every single one of them said that unaccompanied children, if they encounter an unaccompanied child, you know, seeking to access the bridge, they will stop them, and it is their obligation to turn them over to DEEF and not to let them leave Mexico unaccompanied, that they had to have a parent with them or a legal guardian, not just an adult accompanying them. It didn't matter if they had a lawyer, that they would not be able to let them under the bridge because they're unaccompanied. And the Mexican children that I spoke to were told directly that that's because U.S. law has changed. That's what they were told by the Mexican officials. So they definitely will encounter those problems on the Mexico side. Also, INM, who I talked to about the list, you know, the asylum seeker wait list, very clearly told me that unaccompanied children cannot be on the list. And so on the Mexico side, there's numerous blocks. For a child who does make it to the U.S. port, and I think there are some, either because I'm sure, you know, for, you know, maybe they don't get detected by Mexican officials unaccompanied, you know, there are some who are making it to the port. We still encounter children who were turned away by CBP. So
if this is policy, has anyone filed a lawsuit about this?
So there is a lawsuit about turnbacks generally, and that covers everybody, and it gets to your question about metering, period. Mm-hmm. There is currently a lawsuit pending, litigation that was filed by Southern Poverty Law Center, AOL, Al Otro Lado, and I think ACLU.
Right.
and they've received several declarations from us on this practice, and that's about turning people back generally. And that would include children, because the allegations in that lawsuit are that it's illegal, period.
Okay.
So certainly with kids, there's, I think, additional laws that are being violated, right, like TVPRA.
That's right. And I would add that also there are still questions about the legality of the Mexican government and its actors' actions at, you know, depriving access to the U.S. port of entry. So whether that is a question that will be sorted out in the pending lawsuit or that's a separate legal action, we're still in conversations with that.
And are there any numbers on deportations of both children and unaccompanied minors by Mexico going up in recent months?
Sonia, this is Jennifer from KIND. I mean, I think the tricky thing about getting those numbers is that some of these returns, particularly if they're being facilitated by IOM, are being categorized as voluntary returns, and so would not necessarily show up in the deportation numbers. What we saw was that people, after languishing in these camps for long times, may be accepting a voluntary return through IOM. And then for the children who are in DEEF custody, they're being told you can either accept voluntary return or ask for asylum in Mexico. Those are the only two choices that they're given. And particularly for the kids who, you know, suffered in Mexico or something happened to them and they fear persecution in Mexico, that's not an option. Their return would be counted as a voluntary return.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Operator,
okay,
are there any more questions?
Yes, there's another question from Elliot Spago with Associated Press. Please state the question.
Yeah, good morning. I think my question was just answered, but I guess I'll maybe ask to put a fine point on it. Is I think that that list that's kept in Tijuana is managed by the asylum seekers themselves, so it wouldn't be a policy or anything. Well, I don't know. Maybe you can correct me, but it wouldn't be a something by the Mexican government. But just to clarify, there's some sort of policy in Mexico that unaccompanied children can either claim asylum in Mexico or be deported back to Central America. Is that a written policy, or is that something you just observed? I'm just wondering, it's the first I've heard of it, I'm wondering where it came from.
Well, the Mexican officials are claiming that it falls under their 2014 child protection law, and I think that has to be very closely looked at because their child protection law doesn't set out those two options as the options for unaccompanied children. And so we need to, I think, dig a little deeper on, you know, how much of this is that and how much of this is, you know, we don't know yet, but U.S.-Mexico, we have to dig deeper, I think, on that question. But this very clearly, both we heard it from the child welfare officials and we heard it from IOM and we heard it from the Mexican immigration officials, that this is the options that the children are being presented. So it's very clear that is happening. In terms of the list, I would just say, and then colleagues can add, it's actually really, like everything else we saw going on there, it's very confusing for people to navigate, and there's a lot of inconsistent information about what's happening. So technically, or not technically, but in terms of practically speaking, it is asylum seekers who have the book, the list, they're managing it. And we saw that and we even spoke to them, but they are interacting with Grupo Beta, with Mexican immigration officials on a daily basis. And from what we understand and observed, Grupo Beta, well, we didn't observe this part, but what we understand, Grupo Beta is being told by CBP how many people they can take in a day. And that number is changing daily, how many people they can process, how many asylum seekers. Some days it might be 50, some days it might be 15. And then what we did see is Grupo Beta talking directly to the people managing the list that we observed and telling them, you know, communicating with them about what's happening in the port. And so there's clearly some coordination going on. But the, you know, I don't know, Michelle, if you would comment, the U.S. is very clearly aware of this list. The Mexican officials are very clearly talking to the list managers. And so that's what we were able to observe.
Yeah, this is Michelle. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Maria. Were you going to say something?
It's Jen. Go ahead, Michelle. I'll go after you.
So a couple things. Yeah, the list, I mean, look, this is the problem. The list is not official. Nobody, no government, neither the Mexican nor the U.S. government, will officially accept responsibility for the list. And they have made it very clear to me in discussions that the reason for that is that they don't think the list is, that there's any legal authorization for it, right? But so it is, in effect, as far as you can, one can visibly see, being managed by the migrants themselves, who are, you know, physically holding the list and taking people's names and checking those names against the little numbers that they give people on little scrap pieces of paper. But as Lisa said, you know, we had firsthand accounts from people telling us that U.S. authorities told them to go get on the list, right? So they said, you need to go get on the list and come in when your number is called. So they are complicit in that list and in fact, creating the need for the list by telling people to go get on it, right? And then Grupo Beta, as Lisa said, is communicating with the U.S. government every morning to identify how many people from that list will be admitted each morning. And so then they pass that information on to the migrants. So when we spoke to the migrants, when they explained to us the process that they were using, they insisted that that instruction was coming from the U.S. and Mexican governments. I mean, from the Mexican, from Grupo Beta, who they assumed were getting their instructions from the U.S. The reality of where that information is coming from is unclear because nobody will acknowledge it. But from what we could gather, it's the migrants sort of responding to what they're told they need to do. And then I think you had another part to your question. I can't remember what that was.
No, that was basically it. I was just wondering sort of what the official Mexican policy is on unaccompanied children presenting for
asylum. Oh, yeah, the Mexican law. I think Lisa sort of explained that, but it comes from their child protection law, which says that unaccompanied children, whether they're Mexican or not, all children who are on their own, right, minors, go into the custody of DIF, which is their Child and Family Services. So it would be like us saying, you know, if you're an unaccompanied child who's on their own, if you're a child alone, you have to go to the custody of Child Protective Services. It's their sort of equivalent to that. And the problem there, though, is that it's not explicit in the law that they can only be given these instructions. It's just practically speaking what they are told. They're not told about their other options, as far as I can tell. It's the interpretation of that law combined with what they actually provide for the kids.
Yeah. I think, you know, what we saw when we were there in Tijuana is that, you know, DIF is really catching up and trying to figure out how to apply their relatively new law to the population of migrant children. And they're doing so, but the way they're doing it and, you know, what they're taking into account when they're doing their best interest standard and the kind of information they're giving children is much too limited, and it's forcing children either into one of two untenable decisions or forcing children to make, you know, life and death decisions really in a vacuum. You know, they're not getting all of the information. And, you know, whether or not they have family in the United States and where it would be most appropriate for them to seek protection, they're not being offered all of that they should be.
And I would actually say even more, not only are they not being offered those options, but, you know, kids are aware that they won't have access to those options if they fall into the custody of Child Protective Services in Mexico. So that's why we have these kids who are actually avoiding the very entity that's supposed to be there to protect them.
Operator,
again, exactly what TVPRA was intended to prevent.
Operator?
Yes?
Is there any more questions?
That looked like it was the last question. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, we have one that just came in from Angelina Chapin. Please state your question.
Hi there. I was wondering if we have any more information about the small toddler. I think it was Maria who referenced this case who had a seizure. And then the second part of that is, given that it seems like there's health consequences for these children who are waiting to cross the border, and in light of the death of the 7-year-old child last week, what should the health response be by Border Patrol? How does that need to be revised?
As far as the toddler is concerned, I think Dr. Shapiro will be well positioned to talk about the condition of the toddler. By the time we arrived, he was with us. The child was up and running around. The parents had flagged us down to get help for the child and to report that the child had had a seizure and described what happened in detail to Dr. Shapiro. So I think at this point, the child was obviously recovered from whatever incident had happened. We did not personally witness that incident, but there were several eyewitnesses who did. And the child was also consuming formula in powder with no water out of the empty, near empty can of baby formula, which I thought was a clear demonstration of the lack of services and help provided at that particular site. Now, the authorities reported some frustration to us on that population's unwillingness to move to El Barretal, which is the new shelter where there are, there's a medical response, there's a medical tent, and it's, according to Dr. Shapiro, well-equipped. These people are out on the street, and for very distinct and personal reasons, are refusing to move to El Barretal. As far as the conditions for CBP, recommendations for CBP for these families upon arrival, I think they need to focus on their standard operating procedure, which requires them to provide food and water and medical screenings for these people as they come in. We did not tour the facilities during this trip. They contend that their facilities are over capacity, and that's why the metering is happening. However, we don't have personal knowledge from this particular trip on what the conditions inside the CBP facilities are at this time. But I'm going to turn it over to Jen, who may have some additional input.
Yeah. Angelina, and just in terms of, what CBP could do, I mean, I think it's twofold. One is, this false restriction of allowing people to be processed, right? I mean, they're forcing people to live outside in these terrible conditions, which is causing their health to deteriorate. So I think what they need to do first is process people as they approach, right? And there's absolutely, even if the San Ysidro port is full, it's very easy for them to drive people, if they need to use holding facilities down the road, Border Patrol facilities or other ports of entry, to hold people while they're processing them. And then second of all, if the kinds of people that they're taking in right now, the people asking for protection, a lot of them are unaccompanied children or families with babies. They need to hire child welfare professionals to work in their facilities. They have line agents who are trained in law enforcement and how to use firearms caring for children and babies. They need to hire people who have experience and can prioritize focusing on the care of this population while their agents are conducting law enforcement actions and doing the law enforcement processing that needs to happen.
Jen, do you want to talk about the facilities that were built in response to the 2014 surge in places like McAllen, where there was an overflow site for children, where their immediate needs could be attended to right away before its placement with ORR. Mm-hmm. This is not a new challenge, right?
This is not a new challenge, and in fact, the San Diego sector used to drive children, if they were apprehended by Border Patrol, they would drive them over to the San Ysidro Port of Entry because they were better equipped and had more appropriate staffing to deal with that population. So there's no reason why they can't be doing that now. So, getting people off the street so they can process them, and then making sure they're hiring the right professionals inside their facilities. Even if a child's only there 24 hours, it still requires special training to respond to that need.
Yeah, and this is Michelle. If I can just add to what Jen said, I couldn't agree more on, first of all, prevent people from having to be in those conditions in the first place that weaken their systems, right, and affect their health. I would add, and having child care professionals on staff. I mean, we've been talking about this for many years now, and now more than ever, right? I mean, I think the commissioner of CBP told me the other day that 59% of those of apprehensions are now families or unaccompanied children. You know, when you have over half the population that's being apprehended, vulnerable populations, why wouldn't you have staff there to both make sure that their needs are addressed and take the burden off of your frontline officers who have other things to do and different kinds of training, right? So I think it would benefit everybody. It would benefit the employees, the Border Patrol officers, the Office of Field Operations officers, the frontline folks, and the migrants themselves. And then the other thing I would just say is that in creating this backlog of people, not only are they jeopardizing people's health as they sit in Tijuana, where really there has to be a more professionalized humanitarian response that has not happened yet, but also they're driving people into these more dangerous ways of entering out of desperation, right? I mean, people don't want to be sitting ducks just waiting in these horrific conditions. They're looking for a solution. They're looking for a way to save their own lives or their children's lives. So in doing so, you know, in making it difficult to do that, we're driving people into more and more risky situations.
Hi, and I just want to, this is Megan, the moderator, just to say also, I'll remind people of Dr. Alan Shapiro, if you'd like to talk to him and Angelina, he can be reached at 202-724-3301. Now, operator, are there any more questions?
It doesn't look like we have any further questions.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for joining our call. Thank you to our experts. And if you have any further questions, you can reach me at mmckenna@supportkind.org, and I will get in touch with the experts for you. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time, and have a great day.